Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Our guest today is Diane Williams, one of the great story writers of our time. The last time we saw each other was when her collected stories came out. This is a new, slim book. It's very exciting to read, and doubly so because my wonderful colleague, Sean Sullivan, is perhaps one of Diane Williams's favorite readers and commentators, and Sean is here with me. Sean, let's both say hello to Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hello, Diane.
Hi, both of you.
Thank you so much.
So happy to be here. So I've been a fan of you for a long time. And in fact, something of a writer myself, as it is, I had used a portion of Vicky Swinky's A Beauty as an epigraph. I tried to see how I could run off into my own words, which is from the story New Life from Dead Things, which wasn't in your collected stories, by the way. So that just goes to show any listener who already has your collected stories still should read each individual book, which has treasures that weren't shared. But what's so beautiful about Vicky Swinky's A Beauty is the epigraph of that book is a quote by Diane Williams, which is just so lovely. Perfectly safe, go ahead. And I love it so much. And I love the how fully constructed your books are. And the title here, How High, That High, it's people speaking to each other. It's someone saying how high, asking that how high, and another person saying that high. In your previous book, Fine, 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 Fine was the same way. And I wanted to hear a little bit about how the shape of your book comes together and just the whole process of building this book. I would love to hear.
Let's see if I can remember, because I'm so deep into my next book.
Love it.
About
love
the
it.
Title. I was choosing between Thanks Dot, which I thought was funny. It's a title of a story inside this book, How High, That High. And I don't think I had written the story, How High, That High, at that point. I was just looking at a book I have of folklore. It's a treasury of humor, Jewish humor. And looking at the titles, and one of them was How High, That High. I must say, I really admired it so much so that I had to steal it. I love to steal titles. It's great fun. But in the end, I chose How High, That High. I think it, I can't say why, and that rhymes. But I'm interested in rhyme. And the double high, there must be something. And high, high, I guess there, I can talk about it, but none of that was my thinking. High, high is kind of a welcome. Putting the book together is daunting. Absolutely daunting. I don't know which story should go ahead of which story. So sometimes I look at the order in which they were produced, and that gives me a clue. I like to begin with a story that I find welcoming. Enter here, that you're going to be safe, perfectly safe. So the first story in this book is Upper Loop, which is just a few sentences that bring the narrator to a point of safety or danger, depending upon one's point of view.
Let's hear it, Diane.
Oh, okay. Upper Loop. I'm trying to think if there's any reason for having fun anymore on any level. I know that's not the kind of thing people usually talk about, God forbid. So I scale the roof all the way to the ridge, and I have never had to climb down.
Beautiful. That's a first story in its entirety. And when a reader, well, say, like me, reads that and thinks, this is Diane Williams. I feel like you have scaled the ridge and have never climbed down. Do you approve of that kind of reading, taking you to be the voice of the story?
I don't feel I have a say in that.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
But I'm sure some people think that. I know when I read other people's fiction, I usually assume it, which is completely unfair. But I can't stop myself from doing it. Everybody wants to know everybody's secrets. So when one reads fiction and there's the suggestion you're hearing a secret never been told before that maybe should never have been told before, one likes to think it belonged to a real living human being.
My dear friend and colleague, Sean, chose one of your stories largely because it seems to contain comments about how you write, even though it's definitely a story of people who are not Diane Williams, the wonderful writer to whom we're speaking today, about her book, How High, That High, and it's published by Soho Press. Would you read Tale of Human Adventure for us?
Sure. Thank you. Here we go. Tale of Human Adventure. The woman cropped up, and side by side we went afield. But will we ever find our golden plateau of sorts? I don't forget how she once approached me, hunched. I was seated, and then she told me she loved me. Please don't assume she's unappealing or that I'm not interested. She is a long-necked creature, and there are subtle variations in the shadow patterns produced by her facial features. She is easy to motivate, and she shows genuine humility. So with her along, I was bringing a porcelain jar, or it's a pot, to be corrected, mended. There's a better word for pot. There are better words for any of my words. Well, there are born storytellers, and this story should certainly make every point clear, show an enthusiastic appreciation of all things beautiful, supply quickness of thought, and even report climate changes. Recently, I have been unkind to Clara without reservation, and as we proceeded, she crossed her arms over her waist, while a dog who was leashed at his ease looked our way and held up its paw. I'm sorry, I said. And then the woman wore a smile and was turned toward me, one hand at her breast. We skirted an exposed concrete building, an early skyscraper, and finally arrived at the Queen Anne storefront, where the proprietor greeted us and other stylized humans of plaster and marble, as if alive, sat or stood on surfaces everywhere. A toddler. It was a winged boy. One of these figures was actually a girl with her back to us who was kneeling behind the counter. She must have been engaged in stock work, or she was injured beyond reasonable wear. I told myself, don't look. Then I was making a good bargain, and my item, as a matter of course, was examined. My making things better brings an exhilaration that sticks in the memory. My responsibility does not extend to all losses, the proprietor said. I want you to understand. Another customer came in. You're a very handsome couple, he told us. But, he asked Clara, gesturing at me, can you stand him? Clara began to answer, but I cannot imagine not correcting her. I pause here. I think now and again of getting married, but have not done so. Let me say, I wrote all of the above only to amuse myself. Can you hear me? The whole experience of writing this was enjoyable, as is the entire seriousness with which I take myself. In the shop, a bust of Beethoven soon presented itself, and I felt a throb of confidence while taking the measure of his enormous bulk. I tried to tip it, to force him back a bit, but not to crack him. Then up popped the specter, the kneeling girl from behind the counter. I was completely shot to pieces, thinking what I should do about her.
I love it. What's appealing to me about it, and what's appealing to me about so much of your writing, is what in another story you refer to as the wellsprings of spontaneity that I count on to feel alive. I'm so impressed by how you avoid so many of the typical building blocks of storytelling. And I'm sort of wondering, how do you know what you're going to write when you begin a story, or how does it appear to you?
I have no ideas when I begin a story. I know that's always very disappointing for people to hear, but I don't.
I love it. So you discover it yourself while you write it.
Yes.
It reveals itself to you.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. And it's so, I'm just impressed by how often you can do it so well. Sometimes I've heard you're writing the form called poetic. And I think that's accurate, or it's just so different from the traditional structures of storytelling. And I was wondering, is that something that's always been in you and continues to reveal itself, or is that a form that you've been developing?
Well, I think the reason is I'm not able to produce the fiction in any other way. And I appreciate reading fiction that has a kind of cozy relation to tradition. It's comforting. And you know where you are, and there's a certain predictability to it. And if the author has command of suspense, then it's and has command of the language, then it's a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I have nothing against it. I'm just not able to do it, really. I have to write the only way I know, which is a kind of hodgepodge fashion, and throwing words together to seeing what happens when they hit one another. And because I'm easily disappointed and bored with the sentences I produce. So they have to be chopped and rearranged, as does every paragraph, as does, you know, every slew of passages. And I'm also keen to create what for me is a musical composition. So that takes a lot of work to combine sentences in that fashion so that the noise that the words are making makes a certain sort of sense.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. My colleague Sean Sullivan and I are talking to Diane Williams about her thrilling new book of stories, How High, That High. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Diane Williams along with Sean Sullivan, my friend and colleague on Bookworm. We're talking about her new book, How High, That High, which transforms the typical human into a creative accomplishment.
Diane, you had just spoken about the musicality of your stories, and I absolutely agree that there is music to it. There is an inner rhythm to it, and that's what really sings to me when I'm reading it. When I first read your story, I learn of the shape. It reveals itself to me. And then as I become familiar with it and I'm able to see it as a whole, again, the music of it, it just really does sing to me. So the first book came out in 1990. You've clearly grown as a writer, but at the same time, you've always been good. And I just wonder what your writing career looks like from your perspective.
When I think back to the first book, I have very romantic feelings about it. And I don't know how rational or real they are, but it was so exciting to produce that book. And my life was in a kind of chaos, but it was very, very exciting, very painful, but brilliant too, in that I was changing and making discoveries. So I look back on that period and think that many of those stories were written with passion and ease, and it's not true. They were produced with the same agony as the works that I work on these days. There was a stream of energy that I had access to in the old days that I don't have anymore. So that's hard when I think that. But I don't otherwise have much perspective on the trajectory of my work.
I think of another writer who, at least at first, wrote stories that people could hardly recognize or describe as stories. That was quite some time ago, I think in the 70s, Donald Barthelme. But his stories, you can't ignore the music because they don't seem to be written in English or American syntax. He seems to be inventing his sentence, what will be the Barthelme sentence, as he goes along. One of the things I think is marvelous since I started reading your work is how casual the stories remain. They don't stamp their feet. When they make music, they're not thumping. It's an internal music that is special to you. The stories have remained so solidly your own. How did you arrive at a voice so personal, but by and large about ordinary people, workers, clerks, married couples, none of them, you know, extraordinary? They are revealing themselves as casual appropriations discovered as the story goes along. And I think from what you're saying, part of the excitement may be that these things are revealed to you as you write.
That's right. I mean, I'm the most important person as I'm writing. I can't guess what anyone else is going to think. But if I'm disappointed or if I feel inert, then that's the project. I mean, how to get myself to awake and be interested in the minutes passing. It's very hard. So, I mean, I know people who have ideas that they pursue as they create things. And I'm so envious. It sounds so wonderful. And they can often do great works based on a great idea. But I'm listening to my own mutterings as I work. This morning I said, well, that's one way to skin a cat. Of course, that's kind of a tired out thing. But in the context of the story I'm working on, I thought, oh my God, maybe I'm going to throw that right in. And so I did.
I would say that your sensibilities appeal to me and that perhaps I share the same sensibilities, or just a sense of discovery of writerly possibilities, the possibilities within storytelling. And we had spoken about Thanks, Dot is another story that we enjoyed and that we wanted you to be able to read.
Okay, I'm happy to. Thanks, Dot. She was so thankful for that cheerful dot in the sky. And the sighting of the moon served Ms. Coit well as temporary encouragement. She had been weeping, and she does so whenever she can. And it's sad to see how bad this is in what might be viewed as a pleasure house for some. Gee, the full-size moon gained a victory over the woman, Ms. Dorothy Coit, née Hiles. But in the morning, she noted with dumbfoundment the locket that the innkeeper wore. And she thought, maybe if I had bought the one like that one in Philadelphia, everything would have turned out better for me. People love lockets. Rodriga Dobson, the innkeeper, put her life story for Ms. Coit at breakfast, and she was so happy to tell it. Also, Dobson was very beautiful, although the tale she told concerned her severe loss of reputation, as well as an appreciable sum of money. Even so, the aura of the house produced for both women a touch of comfort and low-key luxury. This was especially the case at the core of the house, where the hall walls were covered by wallpaper bearing a pastel lily pad theme, and there was a broad veranda with chairs. "Are you married?" Dobson asked, while Coit plied the pastry Dobson called a kuchen. "Oh, what's a kuchen?" "Am I married?" "I don't know," Coit said. "Have you eaten?" "A plum," Dobson said. And in the crevices, and stuck onto her lashes, sand was in lumps all in and around her eyes. Why didn't she wash the lumps away or just pluck them out? Not the eyes. Dobson was meant to represent, I believe, with her exceptional physical nature, a nearly redeeming being. To whom? To me. Lamentably, she's Mr. Chance, but just now I have yanked the blue frog out from a muddle at a street bazaar. The blue frog. When I say those words, I expect a reprieve, a tavern, tranquility. I see myself in Ireland. We drive, and I spot a roadside to the blue frog, and we go in and have a pint. You know, you have to look at the glass frog with the sun on it. It is the sheer pool of eternity, and I would like the blue frog to go down into my grave with me.
Just so beautiful. I just love how you get there. I love where you take me the whole trip. And I feel that way again and again in all your stories. And again, if people already know stories of yours they like, they have to keep going because they're going to discover each one its own treasure, let me say.
Thank you.
So thank you. It's true. It's true.
I wonder, can you help me? The blue frog and the movement into eternity strikes me as being amazing. How did you manage that? Where did that come from?
Well, I didn't manage it. It was presented to me. My partner, Wolfgang, had just discovered this miraculous frog at a open air flea market. He plucked it out of a jumble of mostly ugly, ruined goods. And he was so excited about this frog. And he put it on his desk. And when I would come in to look at it, he would lift it up and he would admire it and talk about it and tell me why it was such a special frog. So I wanted to believe in it too. And actually it was a Sunday morning. So we got to talking about the blue frog. And then we were curious whether there was a tavern named the Blue Frog. We were thinking of, wouldn't it be great to go to Ireland? This is during the pandemic. So it was a kind of a dream. We'd been planning to go. Why not go to the Blue Frog in Ireland? And then we went to the web and looked to see if there was such a tavern in Ireland. And we found one. It was called the Blue Frog, really. And then it was Wolfgang, who was so excited about this frog at a different point in the conversation that he's the one who uttered that, please send it down into the grave with him.
Oh, wow.
You're kind of telling me that these stories don't exactly come to you. They arrive to you. They're delivered to you.
Oh, that's only sometimes. This was just a miracle.
It was a miracle. It's a miracle story. I think it's so gorgeous, unpredictable, and yet friendly.
Oh, good.
Well, you've amazed me yet again. My colleague and friend, Sean, should be the first one to say goodbye.
Diane, as it is, honor and a pleasure, and I mean it. And I'm so happy to hear that you're already working on your next book, which I'm going to read as well, spoiler. It's been such a joy to me to be able to speak with you, and it means a lot to me, and thank you.
Well, it's meant a lot to me to speak to you, and thank you.
We've been talking with Diane Williams, the author most recently of How High That High, a book of stories published by Soho Press. Thank you, Diane. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael, so much for this opportunity. Thank you again.
I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping remotely, so you may hear various and unusual sounds. It's been a pleasure to talk to one of our favorite writers. Both my colleague, Sean Sullivan, and I love the work of Diane Williams, and it's our privilege to present her on the show again. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at all podcast services and on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. I would suggest that if you enjoy this kind of programming, please become a member of KCRW. How many times do you want me to ask you, as my mother used to say to me at dinner time, and I couldn't come, wouldn't come, didn't come to the table? How many times do you want me to ask you to become a KCRW member? Special thanks to Bookworm Show collaborators Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, both of them very dear to me, and our engineer PJ Shahamat, without whom we couldn't accomplish anything. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm.